Hi, John. How are you?
Doing good. I'm doing pretty good.
Thanks so much for taking time to talk to me about your latest endeavor.
Yeah, thanks for being interested in talking about Bigfoot with me.
I'm always up for talking about Bigfoot. I think Bigfoot is fabulous.
How do you do?
I have to say, the first thing that grabs you when you watch this film is the location. The location is absolutely beautiful.
Gorgeous. Yeah, it's Pendarvis Farm. It's where they host Pickathon in Oregon and outside of Portland. We're actually in Portland city limits, but it's a big concert. Singer songwriters from like all over the place, and that structure, the wooden structures were built for that event that happens once a year. And Sherry Pendarvis and her husband Scott own the property, and there's lovely, lovely people who are actually Bigfoot fanatics, and it all kind of worked out, that we shot there on that farm, and most of it was just there. The bus, everything was just there,
Wow.
Those wooden structures were just there, and it kind of worked perfectly. And then the house was like way on the other end of near Mount Hood, where they shot The Shining, in that whole area. That hotel is out there, and that area where they live is actually like they've had Bigfoot sightings out there. They've actually had Bigfoot sightings out in another area that we're at too,
Oh, wow.
which is pretty intriguing, whether you believe in Bigfoot or not. Just like the just all the folklore around the legend of Bigfoot is pretty exciting.
The greenery, and this is I love because everywhere that, your cinematographer, everywhere that Kevin Forrest points the camera, it's green, it's beautiful, you've got sunlight, you have varying degrees of light coming in with some nice sun flares during the quote unquote orgy montage. But everything, even in the thick of the forest, there is still light coming through that gives us almost a supernatural or ethereal sensibility. It's just so visually beautiful.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, we were really excited about this location that we chose, and we expected to shoot more indoors, actually, inside the house and inside the barn and whatnot, but ended up being mostly an exterior film, and we had to cut down a lot of the Carla and Dean story. We had to cut it out to make room for other things, and just hope that it was there, story wise. But yeah, the locations, the greenery, like making them, a movie that's about sort of this mysterious forest, this mysterious place, and this legendary creature that lives in it was we were trying to communicate that, and that's why these people, this cult, is there. Because it's very special.
Right. And considering you've got this whole group of mountain people and they're so connected to the earth, you want to showcase Mother Nature. And you do that so beautifully. But you shouldn't be concerned at all about cutting out parts of the Dean and Carla storyline. You've got enough of that in there. We know exactly what's going on with them. Dean, actually, for most of the film, is kind of a jackass. Self-centered jackass at that. Carla, Crystal Valdez does a beautiful job with Carla. You're really empathetic towards her. You like her. And you want to see her happy because clearly, hanging around Dean, she's not happy. So we get all of that. And I think, had you included more, we might have been too bogged down in that aspect of the story versus what we ultimately see unfold in the third act.
Well, that's good to hear. Yeah, as a creative, you're, and as a filmmaker, you put it on paper, and then you do what you have time to on screen, especially at this level, at the indie level, And so, yeah, I wondered, and mostly my movies have been about relationships, LGBT, otherwise. It's just been mostly about the way people connect and disconnect, and so I think that's why I was trying to do more with that on the screen, and also go deeper into all the other relationships. But this movie, for me, like being mostly a character driven filmmaker, kind of adding adding more of a plot-driven narrative is kind of is pretty new to me, you know, and especially making a creature feature, you know. So, but no, I appreciate that. I appreciate that.
No, I think you blended it all really nicely, John. And this still is very much character-driven. It's the relationships of these characters. Jesse Taya is fantastic as Arlo. He just creeps you out from the very first moment he appears on screen with this big grinning smile and looking as a throwback to the hippies of the 1960s. You're just caught off guard and suspect, but he always has a smile on his face, which makes you more suspicious of his dynamic with everybody he's interacting with. You knock it out of the park with Isabel, who plays Celeste. Yeah. What a great find. She is amazing. And watching her interaction, her relationship with Arlo, and Celeste's relationship and friendship with Carla is really interesting to watch, because Celeste brings so much to the table as a true believer in this idea of keeping the spirit of the forest alive. Really wonderful. So you really have strong personal relationships happening here.
Thank you. Yeah, I thought so too. I thought so too. And we all want, you know, as filmmakers, like, more time to delve into some of these relationships, you know. But yeah, I believe that there was enough there. We just, you know, I just, you know, you make a film and you hope the audience picks it all up, and it sounds like you did. That's why, like, I love hearing that. And Isabel, yeah, this is a non-union film, so I literally go looking all over the country, every major city, like, you know, all their actors, Atlanta and, you know, the Miami area, of course, because we cast our two leads from Miami, you know, New York and LA, you'll find a lot of union folks. And so I usually end up going to Chicago, and I found her. She'd only been on one short film, and she just had this look and this feel about her. And I was really adamant that she had to be Celeste from the very beginning.
And she brings a great exuberance to Celeste.
Yeah, and she brought so much on energy on set. I mean, she's just a firecracker, you know, and just really just, like, you know, believes in what we're doing is, you know, and an art form, you know, filmmaking. She was so, so excited and happy, and she just kind of, you know, she's pretty infectious, you know, and just like she was at Celeste. I mean, that was like, that was her. that's Isabel, you know, which is pretty cool, you know.
That's how helps the whole vibe of the set when you have someone like that.
It does, you know, and Jesse is used to playing, he usually plays villains, you know.
Yes, I know.
Yeah, he usually plays like the villain, like the, you know, like the Al Pacino, you know, like mafia type, you know. And so for him, you know, he came in and, you know, and I, you know, we found a coach, you know, to kind of help him kind of find this zen, you know, a couple of coaches he worked with. But, you know, I don't know if he really needed it, you know, because he stayed with me during the course of filming. You know, we're still, you know, we only had a few days to really get there, you know, and he looked at me on the way to set one, you know, early in the morning, you know, and he's like, John, don't worry, I'll get it, you know, and he did. It kind of, he locked in, like, you know, the second or third take of one of his first scenes, and he just locked in, and the other actor, Ernesto, pulled me aside. He's like, it's like a computer. It just, like, just clicked on. It was pretty cool. And he had a pet spider, you know, in the basement that he's like, John, I'm going full zen. I'm going full zen on this. You know, he had a pet spider named Frank. His wife came to visit him during production, and his wife is, I think, scared of spiders. And he told her, like, don't kill Frank, my spider.
Oh my God.
Well, Arlo doesn't harm things. You know, he might be who he is, but he's still at his basis, kind of a hippie, be kind to all things. And he's, adamant about the, you know, protecting the forest, but, you know, he also has a power trip of some kind, you know.
You know, as we see things develop about the character of Arlo as we move through the film, really into the last part of the second act and then in the third act, it's really fascinating. But Jesse maintains through the whole film, he is the epitome of a charismatic cult leader.
Mm-hmm.
Very much so. And he nails it perfectly. And that's one of the great things with that you've done with this film, John, because you spin it so that we have a blend of the Bigfoot mythology plus a New Age kind of sensibility melded with the 1960s Age of Aquarius thinking. And then you bring in the supernatural idea or the spiritual idea of the mother and the spirit and keeping the spirit alive. And I love how you meld all of that. So I'm curious, where did the idea for summoning the spirit arise? What was the impetus for this and to bring these primary elements into play to bring this story to life?
Yeah, and so Zach, the co-writer, and I, you know, we talked about making a Bigfoot movie together, and I was in another writing group, and we were with some other writers, and we were trying to develop a Bigfoot story as well during the pandemic, and it's mostly because being in the Pacific Northwest, you can't avoid Sasquatch, Bigfoot. I mean, there's statues everywhere. Every other car has a bumper sticker. You know, like there's sightings. You hear about sightings. You know, and I have a couple of friends who are full time. One's a full time Bigfooter. They have a museum out here, and you know, I had a chance to go out and like Bigfooting with them. You know, in the middle of the night type thing, looking for Sasquatch, doing Bigfoot calls, knocking on a tree with a mallet, you know, with letting the sound, you know, reverberate through the forest, you know, waiting for a knock back. All these things I put into the movie, and it was, you know, that happened like pretty close to filming, but it was, I'd already done a lot of research, you know, on like Bigfoot, the primate, and then also the idea that Bigfoot is like this metaphysical creature, interdimensional creature, and that's why we've never seen, you know, a skeleton or anything like that. You know, it's just, so I liked all those ideas of who the Sasquatch is, and if the Sasquatch is telepathic, you know, it can read your thoughts, it knows your motives, it knows who you are, you know, and then we started, you know, me and Zach started developing this idea, like, you know, well what is Sasquatch's purpose? You know, it's okay, it makes sense, it would be to protect the secret of the Sasquatch and other Sasquatches, you know, if there are some, you know, we didn't go into that in this film. But then, so then we both borrowed from like Taoism, Catholicism, Buddhism, and tried to create a mythology that worked, you know. And so when we had the idea of this stillborn, you know, and like the regeneration of the earth and how it can, you know, how the things that we want in life can manifest and facilitate themselves in a different way, where we can still get what we want, but not in the way that we thought. That's kind of how life is, and so we're putting in all these different ideas. Also, if it being a fish out of water story, you know, two people from Miami who are actually from Miami, you know, live in Miami, coming to the Northwest, you know, some of it was pretty meta in that, you know, I liked the idea of also, you know, my last couple of films or a few of my films have been Latin oriented, you know, and me as a Latin filmmaker myself, I like telling stories with Latino people or about Latino people. You know, the next couple I have coming up are that as well. So I like the idea of telling a Sasquatch story with Latin leads, you know.
Mm-hmm. But the thing is, it's also, you've got a broad appeal. This isn't a film that is only going to speak to the Latin community. Mm-hmm. It speaks to everybody. It's very universal in its ideals. So all the research that you did and what you and Zach pulled from different religions and cultures really all comes together nicely to have a global appeal.
Yeah, cool. I hope that, you know, and even if you're like, you know, because there's that spirituality element,
yep,
that's going through the entire film. You know, and I grew up very, very religious, but not as much anymore. But I still consider myself spiritual, and so I think, like, you know, universally, I mean, I think a lot of us, you know, who don't adhere to a higher power of some kind are probably spiritual in some way. You know, there's something that grounds us, or something, some sort of rule you know, guidelines we have for the way we live our lives. And so I just, I was trying to find, you know, some parallels there, you know, for people, you know. And there was this scene where Carl and Dean, when they, you know, they put the ashes in the forest and then they did the sign of the cross.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, asked to take that out, because it made it less universal and more specific to Catholicism. And so, whereas I would have probably left it in there, I took it out, you know, just to make it more universal for everybody else. It's kind of interesting.
I love where she goes with her necklace and she opens it and pours a little of the ash onto almost a little altar.
Yeah,
at a tree. And that's so beautiful. It's so poignant. It works beautifully. And even the necklace, the pendant that she is wearing is very much, it's the sterling silver cabochon kind of jewel on top of it, which is very metaphysical for anybody that studies any kind of gemology or crystals. So I like that little touch that you did.
Yeah, it kind of gives it some magic.
So I've got to ask you, when you were structuring this, because just so people aren't disappointed, yes, there are horror aspects here.
Yeah.
Quite a lot of them. But you kind of save it and you build up for us. So we get really shocked when things... You shock us at the beginning of the film. And I like the commentary that you... The subtext you provide with the opening of the film about how we treat the land, how we treat the forest. That was a very cool way to set the stage for what was going to unfold, where we have our two people in the woods out to do damage. And then you bring everything full circle with that third act. Was it difficult from a shooting standpoint, the way you have this structured in terms of the bloodletting that we do see within the film?
Oh, yeah. So we did a lot of the blood and gut stuff, like at the very beginning of production. So we had a lot of, and that wasn't by choice. It was scheduling. It was a lot of things. We only had Sean, who played Sasquatch, for a short time. He had a trip he was going to go on. And so we had to kind of move it all to the front. And thankfully we had a lot of energy, you know, for that, because by the time we're, or, you know, third, fourth week of filming, we were pretty tired, you know, you know, 12 to 15 hour days at times, you know, it was really tough. And so, but it was new to me, you know, like, you know, the prosthetics, you know, Melissa Brockman, who made those, she did an excellent job of making a lot of those from scratch and all of them from scratch. She made this deer carcass that was just amazing, you know, and then finding out like a formula for blood that won't stain, all that stuff. But how much time that takes, you know, and how much time it took to put Sean in the suit, about 2.5 hours, you know, and on the first, we only had two applications, two facial applications for the Bigfoot suit,
mm-hmm.
and they're very expensive. We got them from Spectral Motion, together with them and Greg Hale, helped us out with this little indie film, you know, but we only had two of them. And we couldn't afford to get any more, so we had to pretty much put our two scenes where we have close-ups on Bigfoot. We had to put them into two nights. And that first night, we lost about three or four hours. Someone was injured on the first take, and they were fine. They didn't take their medication that they normally take or something. And they were an extra, and so we had to get medical attention for them, and they were absolutely fine. Everything was fine, but it was just, we lost a few hours, and so we were playing catch up, and so we managed to get most of the shots we used that night. But then we had another overnight the next night, and we were still tired, and we decided not to use the close up application for that second night. We wanted to save it when we had more energy, but it was. It was tough. It was tough to add those elements. I mean, like, this is the hardest film I've ever worked on, and I think partially it's because it was a horror film, and partially it's because we had that other element of the creature and the suit.
Mm-hmm.
And the overnights in Oregon, you know, are really, we have maybe like 5 or 6 hours of of actual, you know, night, you know, before it gets light again, you know, so we had to move fast. And it was, it was really hard. It was really tough. So all those elements, you know, the horror elements, all that stuff, like that was all, it was all new to me. It was hard to put together. And also I was new to, and now I realize when you shoot, you know, action like that, you want to get as much coverage as possible, close-ups, you know, like just as much so you can cut it together. You know, I can't really shoot it the same way I shoot, I'll shoot a drama.
Right.
So it's all about learning. Like, you know, sometimes like multiple cameras might have even been good for, you know, for some of this stuff. But it's just, I learned a lot, and it was a blast, and it made me want to step away from just making talkies like I normally do, and actually, like, you know, let's up the ante and just try some different things. Mm-hmm. You know, and somebody in the spirit, you know, was like, it's just one of those things. I mean, that's why it's so nice to talk to someone like you who gets all the nuances that were put into it, because you know, it is a risk to make a movie about a cult that worships Bigfoot and a couple from Miami that moves next door to the cult. I mean,
yep.
It's like, it's a risk. It's a risk for everybody. You know, it's, you know, who knows if it's going to make sense to anybody. I was reading a review where it was just like, you know, this is just a bad movie. There's no critical thinking at all, you know, that's put into it, you know? And I was like, well, it's actually a lot, you know? I mean, I don't know. It's just interesting. Like, you're going to really land with some people and completely miss the mark with others. And I wish I was one of those filmmakers that could just put something out and not care what people think. But
you care.
That eventually happened, you know, after like a few months of the movie being out. But definitely at this point in time, it's like, you know, what's the world think?
Well, you know, something that you did that other filmmakers who have done Bigfoot movies that they don't normally do. What they typically do is they will blur the Bigfoot face. They will blur Bigfoot so you're not sure whether it was a Bigfoot or what you saw. You don't take that tact. You have a scene. Now, most of the shots are at a distance with him just walking through the forest or bending down by a stream to get a drink of water. But you don't shy away from showing us Bigfoot. You're not hiding him. And I really like that. But you also keep a lot of mystery about him until that third act. But it's the fact that it's no secret that Bigfoot is wandering the forest. And we see him plain as day. And I appreciate that you did that.
Thank you. Yeah, that was a combination of a couple of things. I've seen this movie about Bigfoot that's kind of like little known. It's called Letters from the Big Man. It was filmed out in Oregon, too. And they had shots where the Bigfoot was just chilling, sitting down on a log, eating some grass, you know. And I was like, I've never seen this before in any Sasquatch movie. And that suit was amazing, it was, you know. And I just loved it. That was very inspiring to me. And then, you know, we had maybe, like I said, we didn't have a lot of time with Sean, but we did shoot one day of just Bigfoot just walking through the forest, just kind of being Bigfoot. You know, we spent time, a little bit of time, kind of finding like the walk and the pace at which Bigfoot would wander around the forest, and what is she actually doing, you know? And you know, she's appreciating nature, she's eating. You know, there's one where she's sleeping, she's getting a drink of water. I wanted to shoot some just like nature footage, or like almost like gorillas in the mist type footage. And we shot a day and a half of that, and then we ended up just sprinkling those shots here and there, and we didn't really have enough of it. You know, according to our distributor, Darkstar, and Mike Repsch, and he had a great idea. Like, I think you should put more Bigfoot in there. And so we did. We put more Sasquatch, just being a Sasquatch, you know, and just a little bit, you know.
Well, and it gives great credence to the whole idea of keeping the spirit alive, and the spirit that's out there, and the manifestations that Arlo talks about. So it keeps telling us, yeah, he's there. He became omnipresent by doing that. So I'm glad you did that.
Yeah, and it was Greg Hale. You know, Greg Hale is famous for a lot of things, but he made, he was one of the producers of The Blair Witch in the 90s, and he helped us out with this film, you know, in addition to, like, being a mentor of sorts and telling me about creature motivation, to remember that a creature has motives.
Yeah.
And you have to know what those motives are, because it'll drive the narrative. And at the same time, you know, he'd already made a Bigfoot movie in 2014 called Exist, and he's the one who lent us that suit from that movie.
Oh.
For this movie. So that was a case of of one filmmaker helping another, you know, and so that would be appreciative of that. And we didn't really have a Bigfoot movie until he came along, and
I would be remiss not to ask you about your music and your sound, because I have to say I love Michael Semper's music, what he did, the tribal sounds, the wooden percussion sound, percussive notes we have underlying, but also how that's incorporated with the sound design where, and this also goes to the omnipresent nature of Bigfoot, like a wailing, almost tremolo kind of whine of the creature through the forest. Talk to me about working with Michael to come up with the score that he gave you and intertwining that with the sound, because I think that's a wonderful aspect of this film.
Yeah, I think Mike did a terrific job with the score. I mean, I think it's, I don't shy away from saying that, you know, definitely like, you know, the feel of Midsummer was definitely inspiration. You know, one of the things that inspired, the feel of the score and Nicole and whatnot, you know, but like, you know, we wanted to create like this feeling that the forest is a magical place, right? And mm-hmm. so along with all the greenery that you're seeing, you're also hearing like the sounds, you know, this sort of this orchestra, this that's kind of how do we talk about it? It's neutral. It's neither good nor bad. It's just necessary. Is kind of what we talked about. You know, like wanting to, you know, it's sad that, you know, that people have died in this forest, but it kind of has to happen because it's very important to keep this primal creature and this idea and this secret alive. And so things happen that must happen. And so the music's very grand and places and orchestraic and haunting. And it's also scary. Just like, you know, I was just trying to think of a majestic creature in nature, you know, that's going about its day, living its life, and it's very beautiful, but it's also prey, you know,
mm-hmm.
type thing. And it's also a predator, you know, and the nature of nature is like forgiving and unforgiving type thing. So, you know, we talked about those ideas, you know, and we did a lot of back and forth. Tyler Spencer is the one playing the didgeridoo, and he's a renowned didgeridoo player here in the area and otherwise. And we brought him in, and he was he and Luis Hernandez, who were playing music for the Cult, you know, they just improvised like those songs just right there on set, you know,
wow.
Right before. And we just found, you know, they found a beat, they found something that worked, and, you know, and they tried a few things, and we did it all live, you know, the boom operator asked me if I wanted to record a version without them making sounds, and I was like, no, let's just have it all live. I want them to all kind of feel the music, and you know, they're all dancing because they're trying to find their, like, inner primal self, you know, that's another theme of the film, is like your truest self is at your core,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's there in nature, and let's get that person out. So, you know, we did some animal work with a voice and movement teacher. You know, she was working with them through Zoom basically. But I'm also an actor, and I'd done some animal work with her before, and it was really intriguing. It was also a lot of fun. And so, everybody kind of picks an animal, you know, and they, when they're dancing, you know, they're like kind of channeling that animal. And so that's why we had some tribal music in there as well, with the didgeridoo and the box drum. And yeah, but all together, like the music, I'm really, really happy with. And it's really emotional, and
you know, hits the right points and very grand, and also a little, you know, like I said, a little haunting, a little dark in places.
And I have to tell you, we're not going to give anything away, but the final moments of the film where you have the end credits rolling over what is still part of the film is absolutely precious. So precious. And if you've paid attention to the whole film while you're watching it, everything will click for you. And you'll know exactly what has happened. And it's beautiful. I just love that ending. It's very fitting for this film, John.
Oh, thank you. I love it too. I wish I could say more about it. I guess I will later.
Yeah, no, you gotta wait. So now, are you working on anything else right now, or are you at a standstill as well because of the strikes?
Well, I've got a non-union film I've been working on for a little bit. It's called The State Deliverance, and it's about in the near future, if you break someone's heart, you're responsible for helping them get over you. It's a government mandate program in this story. You can be subpoenaed for breaking someone's heart, and if you break someone's heart, you have to go to a retreat with them if you're subpoenaed. It's a weekend retreat. By the end of the retreat, either that person you're in love with will be in love with you, or you will no longer be in love with them, and it's a way to push for mental health in the state of Oregon. And so that's the next thing I'm working on, and it's ensemble. I cast Crystal Millie Valdez as the lead in that one, who's the lead in so many.
Yay! Well, I look forward to that when it comes out.
Yeah, that one, and there's another one at the Union, and we're still trying to suss that one out.
Yeah.
Suss that one out and see if we need to make it non-union or what have you, but it's hard to, like, know what the rules are here, because, I mean, I traditionally made non-union films, and so, I don't know, is it a good or bad thing for me to keep pushing to make movies right now that are non-union?
I think you should.
Yeah, I think so, too. I mean, I want to stand in solidarity as well. At the same time, I've never worked with SAG, not because I don't want to, but because I really haven't been in a budgetary place to be able to make a SAG film.
Mm-hmm.
Personally,
I think we get some of the best ideas out of indie films that are non-union. And this is Summoning the Spirit's a perfect example of creativity that comes together.
Thank you. Yeah, a lot of help.
John, this has been so wonderful to get to chat with you. I hope we get to do it again for your next films.
Yeah, anytime. Yeah, you've been great. Really sweet. You've been actually asking me, like, earnest questions about the development and the work behind this movie. I really appreciate it. Thank you. I'd love to talk to you again.
Anytime, John. And you do have a great rest of your week. And let's hope everybody sees Summoning the Spirit.
Yeah. Yeah, I hope they do.